Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast, where you will get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside of legal nurse consulting. They will share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with 30 years experience. So, join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's Pat.
Hi, this is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. Today we're going to be talking about a topic that is often hidden in our culture, and that is sexual assault. You, as the legal nurse consultant, might be working on cases involving sexual assault that occurred in all kinds of settings. Melinda Norwood, who is with me today, has experience working as part of a sexual assault response team and has been involved in examining over 500 women in terms of sexual assault nurse examiner role. She has she's a bachelor's degree in nursing, and she's currently working as an instructor in an LPN program, and spent nearly 4 years in a pretty remote part of our country involved in helping women who've gone through this experience. And maybe, Melinda, some men as well, I'm thinking.
Yes.
She has been trained to examine women, children, men. Join me in welcoming Melinda Norwood. Melinda, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Pat. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm very excited about it.
Tell us about the training that's involved in becoming a sexual assault nurse examiner, so we know what's involved in helping you assume this role.
You have to be a registered nurse, of course, and then through the IAFN, which is the basis of most of the training that we receive, which is the International Association of Forensic Nursing, you go through 40 hours of didactic at the end of the 40 hours for that 1 week, where you learn all about the program and all about how it came about and everything. Then I spent a day at a women's clinic where we did nothing but 8 hours of vaginal exams, learning how to do those. Then I went back up to the village I was living in and had a preceptor over me for the next 120 hours of exams that I did to make sure that I was following all the correct procedures and protecting all the evidence, as chain of command is so extremely important.
And tell us about the area in which you work, because you mentioned going back to the village. So give us a sense of what was the geography like.
The geography was, we were 490 air miles from Anchorage on the Yukon-Kuskokwim River, and we had a population of approximately 6,000 people. We also had 80 other villages up the Yukon-Kuskokwim River that we took care of. And it was very remote. It's all tundra. It's very isolated and very unique.
And this is in the state of Alaska.
State of Alaska, where I grew up.
Can you give us a sense of how big a problem this is in Alaska?
The last statistics I read was that the rape population was 166 per 100,000. In comparison to a state, say, of New Jersey, which is 47 to 100,000. So, and it's predominantly within the natives themselves, from what my experience was, not with the Gussics, which is what I am as a white person.
And that word again is Gussics.
Gussic, correct.
Okay. Do you have an understanding of why rape is so prevalent within the native population?
I believe the village I was in was classified as a damp village. The natives don't have the gene to be able to process alcohol, like some of our alcoholics don't have that gene either. But the natives specifically don't have the gene to process alcohol, nor do they have the gene to process some of the like boils and other diseases or infections that they develop. So in our village, it was a damp village, which meant that I could bring alcohol in, but I couldn't buy it anywhere in the village. It had to be shipped in from Anchorage. To give alcohol to a native is a federal crime, because we were also on a native reservation. So what they do, just like in the prison systems, they'll make punar, and they'll make that and brew it where you and I would go out to dinner and have a glass of wine and enjoy ourselves and then go back home, not thinking anything of it. The natives get a group of people together and their goal is to pass out. Once they pass out, the guy may wake up and say, hey, you know, to the girl next to him, hey, you want to do it? Well, she didn't say no, so he goes ahead and has his way. And then she wakes up and realizes something's not right, and when we get called in up.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
What is the process that you went through in the 4 years that you were working in terms of how you got notified and then what you did next?
So how we get notified is if they were outside of the village, then every village had a native that was acted as an officer that had been trained to deal with these situations. They would usually contact the state trooper. The state trooper would make arrangements to either fly them in or have, depending upon how critical the injuries are, or have our flight crew go out there. He would notify me. I would notify the advocate for the patient. We always have an advocate in there with the patient. There are two reasons. First of all, the advocate has an in-depth knowledge of all the resources that are available for them after they've gone through this traumatic experience. Second of all, a lot of times they'll want family members or friends in there with them during an exam. What they need to understand is those family members can be called in as a witness where an advocate cannot be. And so it's protection for the patient not to have family members involved in the process. So once the state trooper brings in the patient, then we meet in a single room. It's only the advocate, the state trooper, and myself. The state trooper, of course, wants to know all he can find out about what the identity of the perps are, how many there were, where the crime took place, if there's evidence that can go collect. And after he's finished, then he will go ahead and usually leave and let me start asking my questions as far as what happened during the assault, so I know how to set up the exam room. So it's, and of course, we have to have these patients medically cleared before we can even begin, because if they're still highly intoxicated or if there are drugs on board, we cannot examine them, nor can we do it if there is physical trauma that has to be addressed first. So once this has been completed, we will go ahead and I'll explain to the patient that it takes usually about 4 to 6 hours to do the exam, what the exam entails, because it can be very, very frightening to somebody that's never had delivered a baby or had a pelvic exam before. So they have to understand that I'm going to be examining them for the purpose of collecting evidence for sexual assault. And through this process, they're going to have swabs taken, and any place they've been touched or licked or bitten, or if he's ejaculated on them or rolled them in the dirt or whatever, we need to collect all this evidence. And then the last part of the evidence is collecting doing the pelvic exam and collecting the vaginal smears there. So getting them to consent to this and then explain to them that once the exam starts, if they want the exam stopped, they have every right to. It's their body. We want to give them as much control back to it as possible. But if they want the exam stopped, the exam is finished. What they have to understand is that the evidence that has been collected so far, though, does belong to the state of Alaska and will be sent over to the crime lab. Now, they can file either anonymous or go ahead and file the report with the police department. It's up to them. But the kid is treated slightly different in those two cases. And at that point in time, then I'll go ahead and get the patient set up so that I can do a lot of them, if they follow what we've asked them to, haven't had anything to eat or drink and haven't urinated. So we need to get an oral swab done, completed, and get them something to eat and drink and have them urinate so we can do a pregnancy test on them. And then we have them sign the consent, go through the consent thoroughly with them, have them sign it. While they're relaxing for a few minutes with the advocate, I'm setting up my exam room so that I can go ahead and start the process.
Let me stop you and ask you some questions, because you've given me some thoughts about things that I had no idea. So let's go to my last question, which is the first one, is would a pregnancy test be positive that quickly after an assault?
No, we're not looking for a pregnancy test for the assault. We're looking for a pregnancy test to see if they're already pregnant.
Okay.
Okay. Because of the fact we don't have to give them the morning after pill if they will take it. And we need to explain to them that that is not going to affect the pregnancy that's already ongoing, only prevent a pregnancy from happening from the rape, from the assault.
Interesting. And then you mentioned 4 to 6 hours for the duration of this. And I thought that an exam might be, you know, like an hour long. But can you explain, are there breaks in this, or are you continuously for 4 hours working with that woman, collecting evidence? And maybe you've already explained that, and I missed understanding the duration.
No, it is. It takes generally 4 to 6 hours, depending upon how severe the injuries are. And a woman can be raped and not have any actual injuries. Depending upon how old they are makes a big difference, because if you're within your childbearing years and you still have estrogen that's being produced, the vaginal vault responds differently than somebody that's gone through menopause and or a child, and then there is tremendous trauma usually, or there can be. When I talk about the exam, I'm talking about from the actual interview of where I'm asking them what happened during the assault, because I need to have them explain to me in their own words, and I have to write out what they've stated. So it takes a while. I can't write as fast as they talk, so I have to have them stop, continue writing, restate the statement with them so that I make sure that I'm getting it correct, because I want everything that they've said in their words.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll go ahead and explain that. That can easily take 45 minutes to an hour just to do that. And then you've got to, from what they've said and they're getting the room set up, I've got to, up in Alaska, I had a colposcope, I had a camera, I had Tuolumne dye, I had a microscope that I used. So taking photographs, I could easily take 300 to 500 photographs per session, because you have to take at least 3 photographs per everything that you're shooting. So it will take, in doing the swabs, some of the swabs require double swabs, some of them just require a single swab. Is it for dry evidence? Is it for wet evidence? Collecting clothing takes quite a while, because we have to lay out a sheet on the ground. If they're wearing the same clothing they wore during the assault, then we have to determine what clothes we're going to keep. Because up in Alaska, you take somebody's jacket when it gets to be 40, 50 degrees below zero, they may not be able to replace that, but that's where the women's violence, that bill that was put into effect in 1994 by Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, helps, because they provide funding for all the programs throughout the United States to provide clothing, to replace the clothing that they have to give up during the exam, because they may never see this clothing again.
That's an interesting point.
It takes quite a while to do the entire. Now, the advocate will bring in clothes. They always bring in some panties and bras and pants and shirts if we have to collect everything. But usually we don't. Usually it's just the undergarments that are the most important things. Did they answer your question?
You did. So I'm thinking about what this is like from the patient's perspective, from the victim's perspective. You know what that person's going to undergo in terms of 4, 5, 6 hours being photographed, being probed, being inspected, having pictures taken, being questioned. What do you do as the sexual assault nurse examiner to prepare that person for that long, prolonged process?
When we meet with the police, when the state trooper or the policeman bring them in, I go over that very carefully with them, because I want to make sure they understand how long it's going to take. Because if they have children that they have to get back to, or if they have a time constraint, then we can't obviously do the exam at that point in time. And of course, collection of evidence is extremely important. We have a timeline that we can collect this evidence. So usually it's about 5 days or 120 hours to collect bodily fluids. And if there's been any alcohol involved or drug, we only have 48 hours to collect that. So it's taking it very slowly. Part of the problem up in Alaska, too, is that the natives have their own language and may not know the terms that we use when I refer to the genitalia, or even things such as sexual intercourse. They may not know that term. They may use a more street term. And so trying not to lead them into answering the question, but getting them to communicate with what actually happened can take a while to go through that process. Of course, you're going to have to give them a break so that they can relax. And during the exam, they'll usually ask for a few minutes to relax or compose themselves. The majority of them do very, very well. Unfortunately, there are so many that never come forward because they're ashamed. They feel that it was their fault or that they don't want to go through the trial and have to sit there in front of the people and explain what had happened or having see the pictures passed around about them. They may not feel that they have the money for it. A lot of people don't understand that this exam does not cost them a dime, nor does any of the medication, nor does any of the follow-up. And if they do receive a bill for anything, then we submit it for the advocates and they to the program, and they will usually cover it 100%.
Mm-hmm. I'm envisioning the courtroom, since you mentioned the trial, with this high volume of this type of crime. Can you give us a sense from what you know about how often the perpetrator is found guilty and sentenced? Because it seems like this crime would be clogging the courts with the large number of incidents that are occurring.
Well, in Alaska, what they will do a lot of times is that because so very often the perpetrator is known who it is. They have what's called a glass warrant, where they'll get an order from the judge and they'll sit down and they'll call the person that was involved in it and have the patient sit there and they'll say, "Hey, you know, last night did you da 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 da?" And he went, "Well, yeah, but you didn't say no." And so that took care of him right there, because he's already admitted to it. So that helps prevent the clogging of the system, where we get the ones where I end up have to go to trial are the ones that have been viciously assaulted and have a lot of injuries, and they may not know who the perpetrator is at the time.
And are the courts using DNA evidence to try to identify the people who are involved in the assault?
Yes, and that's one of the questions we have to ask the woman, is that is she, prior to this assault, was she sexually active within the last 120 hours with anybody else, so that I know whether or not I'm going to come up with two sperms. If I am, then I've got to let the crime lab know that there is that potential, or if there are other partners involved also. And unlike down here in the lower 48, up in Alaska, because the villages are so isolated, at the end of the exam, when we go to give them, we ask them how many partners do they have. If they say, "Well, I have four or five partners," then we will give them enough medication to take to every one of those partners to be treated for STDs. Which I know that down here in the lower 48.
Yeah, I guess there's lots of implications. There's the physical trauma, the risk of pregnancy, the risk of sexually transmitted diseases that go along with this. What happens if the woman has no outward physical injuries? Is that something that rules out sexual assault, or is that something that you factor in your examination and taking the history?
Yes, we absolutely factor that into the examination. Just because she doesn't have any injuries does not mean that she was not sexually assaulted. It, like I said, part of it has to do with her age. The body responds. You're a nurse, so you understand that the body responds automatically. We don't have control over a lot of the functions of our body. And if you are of sexual age, childbearing age, then the body's automatically going to start a production of lubrication. Where in comparison to, as I said earlier, some woman who is has gone through postmenopause, the the trauma that we see on them is a lot rougher. A lot of these men, too, up in Alaska, the natives, have some kind of knowledge of the person they're involved with, that they've attacked. And they're not sexually assaulting them violently like some of the men that break into a woman's house and they want to do it as a dominant issue. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It does. Yes. So,
and we do get asked by the officer sometimes, you know, does it look like they were raped? I can't give you that information. That's where the courts describe.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that you've run into instances where women have felt so dirty by the experience that they've gone ahead and taken a bath or a shower before they get to you. How does that impact the collection of evidence?
Well, hopefully if they have the panties that they wore at the time, we can collect that. Unless they douche, but most of the natives don't understand what douching is. And you really don't hear that many people doing it. There's mm-hmm. still hopefully going to put some sperm up inside unless you use a condom. And then of course they may have washed off some of the, if he licked them or bit them or kissed them anyplace else, it's going to affect our being able to collect swabs on that. But we'll still go ahead and do it because the DNA has the collection of evidence. The crime labs have gotten to the point now where all it takes is one little cell and they can process it as long as they are able to do it within a time frame. Now, if it goes to an anonymous kit, it can be held somewhere up to 5 years in the crime lab. And of course, the DNA is dissipating at that time. So how successful they'll be at that time in time is going to hurt it.
I have heard, and I know it wasn't in Alaska, but I have heard of some parts of the country where DNA kits are sitting in shelves after sexual assault and not being tested because of the huge backlog of specimens that have to be handled. I don't know how long DNA is valid in terms of being able to tie it to a particular person. Do you have any knowledge on that?
Not really. I know that in some of the states that they can hold they'll send the kits to the crime lab. Because what happens, once I finish the kit, I have to hand it directly off to a police officer or goes into a lock vault until the police officer arrives. He takes it directly to the crime lab. The crime lab can hold it for up to 5 years because if a woman wants to not file charges at this point in time, then it's anonymous. So we don't know. All we know is a code that's on the front of the box. So if she decides in 5 years or 6 years, the evidence may not be worthy or the kit may not even exist at that point in time because mm-hmm. it's past the time. But like I say, they've gotten to the point where they can really detect DNA for quite a while. And all it takes is one piece of evidence to determine who it was.
Now, I know in our conversation that we've been focusing so far on women, but you've also seen men who've been sexually assaulted and children. What are the differences, if any, between the examination of a man? We'll start with that first, and then the examination of a child.
Examination of a man is usually it's either going to be oral or it's going to be anal. And the tears on if a man isn't used to having sex by the anus, then there can be a lot of trauma there. Men are devastated. I mean, women are devastated too, but men, I'm sure there are far more rapes that go on with men out there that we're not aware of because men are just mortified. And the ones that I saw were usually younger men, teenagers that were molested. I've only seen a few of the men. I think I've only had about 5 or 10 pieces of males. I have had at times where I've had the victim and the perpetrator in the ER at the same time. And we've had to keep them separated so that they're not, because traumatizes the woman all over again. And so I'd have to do an exam on him as well as on her. And then with children are totally different because of the fact that we have in order for them to be where I can sit down and I can ask the female or the male questions about what happened, it takes a special person who's been trained. And in the village I was in, we had a building where the men and women and children, or the women and children were housed after sexual assault to keep them safe before they could go back to their village. And there was a room in there where the children would be placed. There are all kinds of toys. And a woman would come in, she'd sit down, and she'd start coloring and talking to the children and engaging them. And there was a two-way mirror where the police officer, myself, social worker, anybody else that needed to be involved in the case could listen to the examination as they went through it. And she would have an anatomically correct dolls. And throughout the interview could take quite a while, and she'd be talking to the child, and then the child would start saying something about what happened, and she would gather the information. And then at the end of the session, the police would take the cassette, and then I would get the child later on that day or the next day to do the exam. Of course, they're squiggly all over the place. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to go back to something you said, because I didn't understand it. You said that you could have the man and the woman both in the ER at the same time. Now, under what circumstances would that happen?
If the state trooper got there and say it was at a party or something, and they knew exactly who the person was, they could bring both the female and the male in at the same time, because they'd be kept in separate sections of the ER. And they wouldn't know that the other was there. Hopefully, we'd try to keep that quiet. And the woman would be examined and try to get her first, and the police would take the perpetrator off after we did his exam. Because the jail was basically just down the street from us,
mm-hmm.
where he was going to be.
And the perpetrator was being examined for what purpose? Like for due to trauma?
If no.
Fight? Or just
like DNA.
To collect DNA. Okay. Uh-huh. Okay.
Because a lot of the men aren't circumcised. So when you pull back the foreskin, there's a plethora of information there that you can collect.
That's very nicely put, Melinda. So did the perpetrator who is being examined understand the purpose of that exam?
They did understand it. They didn't understand the depth of what they had done, because they didn't look at it as rape. They looked at it as, it's a woman, we want to get together. Well, he wants to get together. And it's just like rape in a marriage is not acceptable. It's mm-hmm. you can't rape somebody, you can't have sexual intercourse with somebody that is unconscious, that is, can't make a logical decision because they're alcohol related or drugged. In Alaska, the natives, I can't tell you how many times I've seen a native come in with alcohol level and a still walkie-talkie of 700-800, and children coming in 10 and 11 years old that have an alcohol level of 200-300.
That would kill some people.
It would.
Wow. Those numbers are astonishing, Melinda.
Yes.
Let me ask you from the perspective of being involved in this, and then we're going to close. Did this ever get under your skin in the sense of what you heard, what you saw? And if so, how did you keep on going in that role? It sounds like it would be incredibly emotionally draining after a while.
On days where I'd have two or three exams come through, yes, it was very draining. And depending upon the brutality of it, the thing that affected me the most was the trauma aspect that the women were going to go through and would go through for the rest of their lives, making sure that they receive the psychological training or counseling that they needed, because a lot of marriages get destroyed because of this. Women is post-traumatic stress. They are severely traumatized, and of course, depending upon how much trauma they suffered at the time. I would talk to other people that were involved in this and realize that what I'm doing is trying to offer them a service, trying to be compassionate, trying to help guide them through this horrific event that they've gone through. And if I can do that and get them to feeling safer and realizing that it was not their fault. No matter, I can remember as a child, as a teenager hearing, oh, well, if you dress that way, then you're asking to be raped. No, you're not. as a female, I have a right to go to a party, to drink, to do whatever I want to, and not have anybody touch my body or do anything that I don't want done. This is my body, not anybody else's. And this is what I try to portray to them. So it's not their fault. They have no guilt, nothing to be sorry for. If I can get that message out to all women and hopefully get them all to understand that this exam doesn't cost them, please come in and see us because we are there to help them.
I appreciate what you shared with us, Melinda. It's a difficult area of nursing practice, and I'm so happy that there are nurses who take this on to support victims who've gone through this tremendously disturbing and injurious experience. Our listeners are most likely going to want to get in touch with you if they have a sexual assault case and they need some insight in terms of interpreting the medical records. What would be the best way that they could reach you?
The best way they could reach me would be by my email, which is Norwood, N-O-R-W-O-O-D, Melinda, M-E-L-I-N-D-A, no spaces, no caps, @gmail.com. I've moved down to the lower 48, and I am looking to get involved with the sexual assault team in my area. And hopefully once I do that, then I'll be able to get up a website so that I can get more involved with the attorneys or with nurses that are handling this.
Thank you, Melinda. I appreciate you being on the show. Some of the key points that I think that you've covered that have really opened my eyes is the high rate of sexual assault where you were, the fact that it's often alcohol related and much of it is not reported because of the shame and the embarrassment associated with the experience. I've learned today that the exam is much longer than I ever dreamt and that it involves a lot of meticulous collection of evidence and questioning and making sure that you're not putting words in the mouth of the victim. It sounds like there's extensive documentation, photographs, specimens, and even one cell of DNA is enough to connect the victim and the perpetrator. Right. And I think you've also highlighted the special sensitivities involved in men who've been sexually assaulted, as well as children, in helping to get a coherent story from the children and the special techniques that are involved in questioning them. You've got a lot of valuable experience. I hope our listeners have an opportunity to be able to use your services in what is a very difficult aspect of healthcare.
One thing I'd like to say, if I may, real quick.
Sure.
Is that once that kit is opened, I cannot leave that room. I have to stay with that kit until it is resealed. So the evidence collection is so important that we keep control of it before we give it over to the police department.
Yeah, that's crucial, that chain of evidence, to make sure there cannot be an allegation in the future that, oh, well, it wasn't me, you know, must have been somebody else, because that nurse turned her back and left the room and came back an hour later, and who knows what happened in that time. It's a great point.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Melinda, and thank you to you listening to this show or watching this show on our YouTube channel. We'll be back next week with an interview that will be new on a different topic, and we appreciate your involvement in Legal Nurse Podcast. This is Pat Iyer and Melinda Norwood signing off.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on LegalNurseBusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at LNCAcademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Join our community to get notified of each new episode and to receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. We appreciate you and your interest.